Well, hello everyone. Thank you for tuning in again. We have another great topic, another great theologian that we're focusing on, and that's John McQuarrie. And the person we're going to be bouncing thing off of is our own theologian, Father Jim Basic. Good to be here with you again.
I'm ready, Brad.
You're ready. So, John McQuarrie, I'm going to roll the ball out, and you take it and go. So give us some background. And I say that because he's obviously a theological giant, but he also has a personal connection to you.
Yes, yes. And I might as well get that out right away.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I was in New York studying at Union Theological, at Fordham and at Union Theological, which is a great, Union was a great center for theologians from all over the world. And it was Hans Kung came there, our great scripture, Raymond Brown was there, Hans Kung, it was, and John McQuarrie taught there. And McQuarrie grew up as a Calvinist type. But his own spirit, sort of a heavy Christianity, a lot of negativity and so on, and a somber version of Christianity, which didn't fit his own psychology or his own mood. And he became much more open and joyful and positive about the Christian faith and became an Anglican. And I would consider him one of the great Anglican theologians of the 20th century, and a brilliant mind. And so anyway, he was teaching at Union Theological, and I took his course. And I was so impressed with him, impressed with his wisdom, with his ability to deal with questions and students, his background, knowledge of the tradition, his own gentle nature and so on. And I was in the process of figuring out who I wanted to follow in doing a dissertation. And in one course with him, I said, this is the man I want to study under. This is the man I want to supervise my dissertation. And by then, he had moved to Oxford. He was a Lady Margaret professor at Oxford, England, very prestigious position. And I was in dialogue with him, and he invited me to come and be his student in Oxford, and which I was very grateful for. And so he was the supervisor for my dissertation. Mm-hmm. I always tell my friends and who are working on their doctorates, one of the main things you want to do is find a supervisor who is self-confident. Mm-hmm. Because sooner or later, you're going to know more than your supervisor about the topic, because that's all you're doing. And at that point, your supervisor has a couple of choices. One is to let you go and pursue your own way, or to try to rein you in and write a dissertation that he wants. And so that was, my intuition was exactly right. McQuarrie was great as a supervisor. He knew Rahner, knew the tradition, could give me tips, told me particular courses at Oxford that I should take. And was a great dialogue partner, but essentially he let me write my dissertation, which I was very grateful
for.
What
was your dissertation topic?
Well, it was on Karl Rahner.
Karl Rahner, there
yeah.
You go.
Apologetics and the Eclipse of Mystery is how it's published. My family and nephews and nieces and so on always kid about it, that it's indecipherable, that I gave them a copy of my dissertation, Apologetics and the Eclipse of Mystery, and they will always kid about it, like, you can't understand
Thank
it at
you
all.
For that, right?
Yeah, right. What am I going to do with this? Anyway, it's a dense text, to say the least. But McQuarrie approved it and wrote something good about it, as did Rahner, by the way. John McQuarrie's a good, big influence on my life. I mean, he invited me to dinner at his house, introduced me to his wife, Jenny, and we had pleasant interactions, and he was encouraging. And so, yeah, he's an important figure in my life, really.
What can you
in fact, when late in his career, They had what they call a Festschrift. The Festschrift is when you get a particular professor's students and friends to write nice things about the individual. So there was, I was invited to write one of the chapters on for John Macquarie's Festschrift. I think it was on his 80th birthday, which I was honored to do. And so there was some connection that way.
So should we get into his theology as far as what the bulk of that? And do you want to start with the...
We can do. Let me think about that. I mean, as I say, he was a Calvinistic type. John Calvin had a somber notion of Christianity, and that influenced the Presbyterians here in the United States. They're Calvinistic and so on. And Macquarie broke from that, essentially, and went out on his own and learned a lot from the Catholic tradition. He was in great dialogue with the Catholic sacramental system. Sort of the celebratory sense of Catholicism intrigued him and so on. So he was very open to dialogue, and he learned a lot from interaction with other theologians. So he would end up being, he was critical of Karl Barth. Karl Barth was the founder of Neo-Orthodox theology, and Barth was critical of that. I mean, Macquarie was critical of that line of thought. He really believed that we should be in dialogue with the modern world, and that that dialogue could be fruitful, and that we could have what we call a mutually critical dialogue, where Christian faith dialogues with what's going on in the world, and it's possible to learn both ways. So that I would say that the church could learn from the Brooklyn Dodgers, who hired Jackie Robinson before we desegregated churches, you know, or the church could learn from the way women had advanced within the corporate world. So there's a mutually critical dialogue where each side has something to offer, and each side can affirm something in the other, but each side can also criticize in the other. So Macquarie was very good. Macquarie had instincts very much like Karl Rahner. He didn't just know Rahner. A lot of his sense of life and what Christianity was all about was like Rahner. And he knew Rahner's thought. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what I think we should highlight in talking about Macquarie is his anthropology. The Greek word for man is anthropos, so we have this study of anthropology, like we have a study of psychology, you know, the psyche. So we have the study of human beings. So we call that anthropology, and that's where Macquarie really shines and where he was made great contributions. Now, one of the things that he understood was that we are complex people, human beings. We are self-transcendent in the sense that we're always moving beyond. If we know this much, we realize we need to know more. Self-transcendent, we're always moving beyond where we are now. We're on a journey towards a love that's deeper and imperishable. So we're always seeking deeper love, always seeking deeper knowledge, seeking better involvement in our community. We're on a quest, a lifelong quest, and that is makes us people who can never be satisfied totally with where we are on the quest. Mm-hmm. We're always moving forward. It's like Augustine said, that our hearts are restless, Lord. You made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. The heart is in process. So Macquarie had a great sense of that, and that he understood that there are different tendencies. This is a hard thing to talk about, but to get straight. So maybe keep in mind a question that'll clarify it. But I call it, what I got out of Rahner and what I got out of Macquarie was that we have to mean a dialectical anthropology. We have to, as healthy people, what we want to do is keep two opposing tendencies in fruitful tension. The best way to do this is to do it by example. So a dialectical approach means that I realize, let's use the example. So one of my dialectical virtues based on Rahner and based on Macquarie is what I call committed openness. Committed openness. Now, we could say, well, I'm so committed to my political point of view that I'm closed to what anybody else says. You know? Or we could say that I'm so open to any idea that I'm prey to relativism. I have no standards in whatever. So what we want is healthy people who have committed openness. So it's not just that on Monday I'm committed, or Sunday I'm committed when I go to church, and on when I go to work on Monday I'm open to my colleagues. It's not. It's I live every day as a person of committed openness, where the two fruitfully interact. So you could put it this way. In a healthy person, the more committed they are to their religious tradition, whether it's Islam or Judaism, Buddhism, Christianity, Catholicism, because they're committed, they're open. The commitment is what opens us up to listening to others. And our attempts to interact with others, to our friends, to learn from what's going on in the world, all of that is what moves me back to be committed. So that as I live on a day-to-day basis, I live as a committed, open person, where the two fruitfully interact. So it's not, I'm repeating myself now, but it's not that for this day I'm committed, this day I'm open. It's every day I'm a committed, open person.
Right.
And the more open I am, then instead of it making me a relativist, and anything goes, and wishy-washy in my convictions, instead of that, it moves me to be more committed.
What's the role, and did Macquarie see something, a benefit to a healthy life is filled with opposites? Is that what you're getting at?
Seeming opposite. Like if we're just talking, we say commitment and openness sound like they're opposites, right?
Yep.
And they can be. I mean, I can be so committed that I'm not going to listen to you, Brad, because I'm committed to my outlook on sports.
But there's a healthy tension between those.
You got to have a healthy tension. What I think is true.
Can you give another example?
Yes, I got a bunch of them.
Let's go.
What I think is true is that healthy people hold opposites in a fruitful tension. You can tell that in interacting with them. So, yeah, let's try another one. I'll call this one hopeful realism. Hmm. You know, so.
And you use that, you like that.
Oh, I like it. I like all these, all these examples, these dialectical things, yeah. That in my own reading of Macquarie and Rahner, that's my way of understanding their anthropology. There's a lot of ways of understanding a person's anthropology, fundamental outlook on human existence. My way is dialectical, and that's how why I resonated with Macquarie and with Rahner. And in the Festschrift that I wrote, a chapter in his Festschrift for Macquarie, I compared Rahner's notion of anthropology with Macquarie's, and which I saw as very compatible and really on the same wavelength. So now I'm on hopeful realism, right? So so sometimes you say, I'm so realistic about what's going on in the world right now, I have no hope for anything getting better.
I'm beaten down.
Yep. Discouraged. I'm cynical, I'm not going to participate in the political process because it's so messed up. I'm not going to vote anymore. You know, I'm realistic. We're not going to get any place. I'm realistic about the war. We're not going to solve our war situations. On the other hand, the danger on the hope sign, hopeful realism, is a utopianism. That is, the world's going to get better. You know, we're not going to lose our democracy. I don't know how, but God will intervene. We're not going to lose it. Don't worry about it. We will remain a democratic republic just like we've been for all this time. It's a utopian thing. It's not realistic. And so trying to put the two together again, let's take this example. Here's a guy with a gambling problem, okay? Like the taxi driver I had who had lost his wife and his house and so on, and I get in his cab, he says, I'll bet you I can get to the airport in 20 minutes. You know, the man can't get any place. He's stuck, you know. So okay, we got a gambling problem. So the first thing that has to happen is he has to realize the reality, the realism is he's got a gambling problem. And he can't go to a casino. You know, he just can't do that. He's going to lose his second wife who he married. So the realism then opens up the hope of progress. So as soon as, this is the AA trip, the 12-step programs all, I got to admit I'm powerless over drink, over pornography, over whatever it is, gambling in my example here. It's by admitting that I'm powerless over that, that's when I have hope. That's when I have hope to make progress. Right. You know, as soon as I say, yes, I got a gambling problem, and I got to join Gambling's Anonymous, I got to follow the program, and in doing so, now I have hope that I can get over this problem. So hopeful realism, bringing together, again, the same theory, two opposites, seeming opposites, and you can go wrong on either side. So I call these virtues. I call committed openness a virtue. In the Catholic tradition, virtues are habits, ingrained habits, ways of acting in which doing good sort of flows naturally. Yeah, so if you have the habit of hopeful realism, then you're okay. You can go to a casino and not worry about over gambling or spending too much money. So habits help us to do the right thing easily or promptly or without much tension. That's what we want to get to. We don't want to live as Christians biting our tongue. I can't do this. I can't do that. I can't gamble too much. I can't drink too much. You know, we don't want to live like that. Right. We want to be joyful. And by having a hopeful realism, it helps us to be more joyful people.
You've used that at lectures and in homilies, and it's a real effective. It resonates with me, and I think a lot of people. It gives a context of life.
I use it all the time, don't
wonderful.
I?
I like it. I really like it.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite things. I'm not sure it's original, but it's mine. Okay. I use it a lot, and that's what I hear from people. You know, that's my experience. It's so easy to be one-sided in life.
Yeah. Back to your dissertation, then, Munch. Did the term or the theme or the concept gracious mystery, did that come out of your dissertation? I know you have a book in the late 80s.
It's called Gracious Mystery.
Did it come from the
dissertation? Not directly.
Not directly, okay. No.
The idea of dialectical virtues, for sure. But the gracious mystery, again, is one of my favorite phrases I use it all the time. I have a book under that title. Almost all of my books are dedicated to some person who illustrates the gracious mystery to me. I love the phrase. I mean, a lot of people like it. You know, we can say God's the omnipotent one, of course. God's all powerful. He's all this, all that. But gracious has a kindness to it, a tenderness, a God who holds us in the palm of her hand. You know, it's, yes, that's, I'd like that gracious mystery idea.
Yeah. Hopeful realism, gracious mystery. Those are really strong.
Yeah.
Conceptually, and it paints a vivid picture of theology.
Yeah.
In a really short phrase. Back to Macquarie, he was obviously very big in this idea of the role of reason and the quest for self-knowledge.
Yeah. Yeah, he believed it in philosophy as being the handmaid of theology. That comes from Aquinas again. It's a traditional Catholic thing that philosophy is something good. You know, there were elements of Protestantism that said philosophy is bad. It's not useful. It gets in our way. Don't rely on reason, rely on the scriptures. And for Catholic traditions, we've always had the both and. We want to learn both from philosophy and from theology. We want to have faith, and we want to have our own efforts. So it's the two things go together. But Macquarie had believed in the value of philosophical theology. See, he was a great student of Martin Heidegger. Now, Martin Heidegger was a great existentialist. He wrote Being and Time, and German, obviously, he was often thought of as being too open to the Nazi thing. I'm not sure if that's valid or not. I don't want to, you know, take either side of that, but often accused of that. But Macquarie translated Being and Time into English and was a great student of Martin Heidegger and influenced by it. And of course, Heidegger insisted that the philosophical world could lead us further, but not to God. Mm-hmm. So Heidegger said, we humans quest. We are in a quest, in a search, but we can't get to God that way. Although I remember Rahner telling me one time someone saw Heidegger go into a church and genuflect, and Rahner says, you're surprised at only if you don't know Heidegger. Only if you don't know Heidegger would you be surprised at that. In other words, Rahner thought that in Heidegger there was a secret theological dimension that you could discover, and I think there's a lot of validity in that. But the point here is that Macquarie did discover in Heidegger a secret theological dimension, and something that followed through to the end could lead one in the direction of God. I chose my words carefully. Could lead us in the direction of God.
Right. Macquarie also had its thoughts on self-transcendence. Mm-hmm. And how that, what that means and how it manifests into the human experience.
Yeah, yes, it's one of his favorite phrases, and it's connected in with all of liberal theology, as represented by Rahner and so on. Self-transcendence, that we're always going beyond where we are. So, you know, I say, you know, you go out west and you have this great trip and see us so on, and come back, and you all of a sudden somebody says, yeah, but did you get to Vegas? Oh, no, I got to go again. So that there's always something more. That nothing satisfies the human heart. Our hearts are restless, Augustine. You know, so we are transcendent in that sense, that how much knowledge we know opens up more knowledge. So for a lot of people, when they're learning, they learn more, but it's not like a closed box. There's this much learning, and now I got 90% of the box. If I could just get the other 10%, I'll be a savant or something, you know. It isn't like that. We all know that. To learn something means that it opens you up to more questions. That's to be self-transcendent. Right. Same way you can do the same analysis with love. You know, you could love your spouse and at some point find out that she's even more mysteriously wonderful than I realized. Mm. And it opens up a new dimension in this spousal relationship. I see her now in a new way. I appreciate her in a new way.
Yeah.
Well, how much time we got?
A couple minutes.
Should we take another dialectic? I don't know if that's good or not.
Can we finish the self-transcendent?
You lead. Go ahead.
There's a point where he goes into a taste of the infinite.
Yeah.
And that talks about afterlife.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. I haven't thought of that in a long time, but that brings back some conversations with him. A taste for the infinite. He got that from somebody. Who was it? Kierkegaard? I don't remember. He got that from somebody. A taste for the infinite. And that's whole same self-transcendence, restless heart. It's all that we're hardwired for God. That's a contemporary way of saying it. We are programmed for God. There's certain studies that suggest that. I don't want to take that too far, but God is part of our whole outlook, our way of life. So we have a taste for the infinite. And Macquarie liked that phrase, and it points to a way of speaking to the modern world. In other words, if I'm talking to a secular group, what I want to do is tap that taste for the infinite.
Yeah.
I want to find some way of talking about life, experience, work, friendships, marriage, that suggests the taste for the infinite. That when somebody can realize that I have that. Yeah. I always go back to that example of marriage encounter where a guy before the marriage encounter says, well, I don't know where I'm going. That's where you go and you write about what your spouse, you give them a topic. Aunt Ellen, what do you think? I can't stand Aunt Ellen, the guy says. Well, I always thought you liked her. In which they learned from one another. So the guy says beforehand, I could read my wife like a book, and afterwards, she's newly mysterious to me. I mean, I always think of that example of what it means to be self-transcendent and to have a taste for the infinite. Yeah, the infinite.
Well, how about if we close with another virtue? Dialectic virtue.
Yeah, I can't think of which one I want to.
You get so many. I know they're their favorites. Right?
Yeah. How about reflective spontaneity? How about that? Reflective spontaneity. In other words, here, the danger is that we don't live spontaneously, that we're always programmed, we're always thinking, well, what impression will I make on other people? Do they like me or not? Am I coming across? What about my public image? I can't be spontaneous. And so that virtue, reflective spontaneity, means that, so one of the things is I'm not spontaneous. The other thing is I just live such a busy life, I don't have time to stop. I remember one of my friends ended up in the hospital with a heart attack, and his line to me when I came to visit him was, I got stopped for speeding.
Hmm.
He lived a frantic life, a business life. He was corporate. He was hardly had time for anything else. For relaxation, I got caught for speeding, stopped for speeding. And so it's a great example. The other tendency is not to meditate, not to pray. But the interaction again is, if I meditate, if I take time out each day to reflect, if I have a quiet time, then I get my head straight. And when I go to the casino, I won't over-gamble, you know. Or when I'm with this person that I don't like, I'll be fine. I'll be amiable and so on. Because I've been reflective, because I've realized my strengths and weaknesses. Carl Rogers, a psychotherapist, says one of the great things of maturity for human beings is I can trust my spontaneous reactions. I can trust myself. If I go to a party, I'm not going to drink too much. I might have a couple of beers, but I'm not going to drink too much. If I go to church, I'm going to, even if the homily's lousy, I'm not going to get mad. I'll have my own thoughts and meditate on what I got out of the scriptures and be nice to the priest when I go out who gave a lousy homily. You know, so reflective, that's a good one. I'm glad you brought that up. Reflective spontaneity. So the value is that we need to be reflective. You got to have some quiet time. Got to stop the noise sometimes. Got to try to listen to God. Try to listen to the Holy Spirit who whispers. Right. And if you got music and television on all day, he's whispering, you don't hear him. No, so yeah, reflective. So the more reflective I am, the more composed I am, the more I'm in touch with myself, I can trust my instincts to live a Christian life without gritting my teeth. Reflect. So what do we got? Committed openness, hopeful realism, enlightened simplicity. That's three out of my list. That's
Those
enough.
Are three great ones.
That's enough.
That gives us something to chew on and to apply to our own
lives.
I
love it. As one of my students once said, I like your homily. It gives me something to chew on during the week. First time I've heard that in years.
Maybe with I said maybe that 40 years
maybe
ago.
Maybe that's what you said. Yeah.
This was wonderful. Thank you for giving us a great context on John McQuarrie and his impact on theology, spirituality, and on you personally. It was great.
I love working with you, Brad.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah.